Welcome, welcome, welcome. Anyone who's tuning in, who's listening to us, this is Story Trek. I am your co-host, Michael Stridigakis.
I'm your co-host, Marshall Hopkins.
And this week, we are talking about number ones. Now, what's a number one, you ask? Well, it could be a couple of things. It could be the nickname for the first officer on a ship, or it could be the number one being the number one person on a call sheet on a television or film production. And what we're talking about today is a little bit of both, because the question here is, can the number one on the call sheet be something other than the captain and the show work? What exactly makes a Star Trek show work with a lead actor or actress?
It's a fascinating question because, you know, Star Trek has done both perceptions. They've done one, you know, shows where we start off with one captain, that's the captain throughout the entire series. That's most Star Trek series. And then we have a couple where we've started off with someone who was the first officer, who was also obviously leading, pretty inarguably, but arguably, an ensemble cast. So in the two instances in Star Trek where this has happened, eventually these people became captains. So the question is, can a Star Trek show work without someone, you know, with someone who is in the lead who is not the captain? Or does it just break the formula?
So I guess the first question we have to ask is, what exactly is the formula of Star Trek when it comes to lead characters?
So just to lay out the fundamentals, so typically your lead character is usually the leader of the ship, the person through whom the audience sees most of the action or most of the events that take place. That's the formula. Now, sometimes the captain is the person who leads most of the stories, as you saw during TOS. That may have had more to do with William Shatner than it did storytelling, but that's neither here nor there. But another part of the formula that we have here for a captain is the fact that this person is usually the centerpiece of most of the stories. So you have many, many stories throughout the different series that focus on different characters, another member of the ensemble. But a lot of the stories typically tend to revolve around either the captain's life or the captain's decisions or what the captain chooses to do in a particular scenario. Now, is it possible to have that same degree of agency with someone who isn't making the decisions?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about Star Trek, when you look at its very genesis, is it's typically revolved around one to three characters, mostly two to three characters. And these characters are usually in a leadership role within the ship. Now, you look at our first instance of Star Trek without a captain being the number one, and you'd look at Commander Sisko. You could also say Star Trek Discovery with Michael Burnham, a first officer demoted to prisoner, promoted to unknown rank, lieutenant, commander, and then now a captain. We could also look at character from Lower Decks, Mariner. So Mariner is another first officer turned lower level Starfleet personnel on Lower Decks. So we have, in effect, technically, Commander Sisko, Michael Burnham, and Ensign Mariner. Now, there's a lot of things we could talk about with regards to the surprise that all three of these characters are three black leads we have in Star Trek, which kind of makes me pause and wonder about that. But we also have to look at it and say, how does this, from a story perspective, their role not being the first, being the captain, how does that affect things? Now, in the cases of Sisko and Michael Burnham, they're both eventually made captain at the end of the third season, like we talked about in our earlier episode when we ruminated about this. But the thing that's interesting to me is that was the decision to make, especially with Michael Burnham, was the decision to make her captain more about the progression of her character, or was it because of limitations within the framework of what a Star Trek show is?
For me, that's a big part of the challenge of the question, because I can honestly see, I can conceive of a show where it does not revolve around the captain, But I think that that only works if this story is about, not necessarily about that person aspiring to be captain. You know, you don't want to do a Sam and Diane the entire time. At the same time, I do feel like you can have this story where this is the person who does the work. You know, you do have those stories where you have the administrator who just sort of administrates, and then you have the person who does the dirty work. If you think about it, this is the basis behind most cop shows, right? You have a desk, you have a sergeant, you have a captain, you have somebody who gives the orders, and then you have the main characters that you follow who carry out the orders. So I do think that there's a framework by which you can do, the number one, the second in command, being the leader of the storyline. The problem is, for me, is that you have this aspect of aspiration, right? So it always feels like this person is not quite where they should be to take care of all the things that they've been assigned. Like you look at Sisko, who in the first season of Deep Space Nine is a commander and he's in charge of a space station. But he has these interactions with Gul Dukat, and Gul Dukat is clearly high ranking above him. You know, and I think that the interesting thing of the dynamic was that, you know, Avery Brooks as the character never gave an inch of ground. It didn't matter if he was a commander or not. You were still going to, you know, he could still verbally spar with you. He would still demand his respect. At the same time, there was always this imbalance. So I feel like with the Star Trek series, with the exception of Lower Decks potentially, because we haven't seen as much of it, there's always this aspirational aspect of this person isn't there yet. You know, this is not, you know, they're not fully formed is the impression that we get every time we see someone who is a commander on Star Trek, as opposed to this is my rank, this is my job. So I feel like that's kind of the problem with it. And then there's time in this episode we're going to cover, or I want to discuss on a little bit in detail, you know, the optics of the fact that the three times that this has happened, as you mentioned, it's been a person of color. And I don't think anybody intended that in Star Trek. At the same time, again, look at the optics. This is not the best look.
No, I'd be really shocked and amazed if somebody actually sat down and said, okay, we're going to do this. It's some sort of like implicit bias is the way I'd look at it, though.
Right. I mean, there is something disturbing about the fact that the three African-American leads that we've seen for a Star Trek series always had to earn their rank or always had to prove that they could accomplish. Yeah. So it gives you this impression that you have to prove that you're the equal of Picard or Kirk or things like that in a way that nobody else really has to prove themselves. You even look at Janeway, and Janeway is immediately accepted as the authority. And if you don't accept her as the authority, she'll put you in your place pretty quickly.
Right. And I mean, it's bizarre because I mean, you look at it, Sisko, there's no explanation. Like there's no in-story explanation that I can figure that he's not promoted to captain even. Like within the end of the pilot. Like I can understand for the pilot that he's a commander, but once you get past the pilot, I don't understand why he's not immediately promoted. And that's just part of the story.
And we can even cover how many different things that Sisko had to deal with that, you know, would stump many of the other captains we've seen. He is a religious figure. There's the thing about some of the other captains who would have bungled that at that point. Picard couldn't handle being a religious figure. There was the whole episode who watches the Watchers. Mm-hmm. He couldn't handle that. Kirk, he would just leave the planet. He would never come back.
Your Bible's a lie.
Yeah. So Sisko had no choice. He had to both be a diplomat and a religious figure. And he has to deal with this culture that has been abused by genocide and slavery for a half a century. So again, there's no reason why, given the challenges that he had, why would you not promote him to the rank of captain? Why did he have to prove through various conflicts that he could do this when he's already damn doing it?
Yeah. I mean, there's no story explanation for, and it was never like a story, like limitation of his rank affecting his ability to lead. So there's no payoff to keeping him as a commander It's just simply the optics of it. That's what it looks like.
Right. There were no set challenges that he needed to face. Now, with Discovery, you can make the argument that Michael Burnham definitely evolved. She went from someone who was willing to commit mutiny in defiance of her captain just because she thought that she was right and only her perspective mattered, to this woman who is the captain of the ship, who is both the kind of the mother of the ship, for lack of a better phrase. The emotional core of the ship is basically her. You can say that that's intentional. You can say that that's unintentional by the writer, whatever, but that's the case where it is. So I do feel like with Burnham, you do have this sort of evolution where her character needed to change in order to get to this point where, yes, you understand that, you know, your entire ship may die. You may lose crew members, but that is a part of the job. Sisko was there from minute one. The only limitation he had was that he did not want to be on DS9. He wanted to continue grieving his wife. And he overcame that by the end of the pilot.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about Discovery, especially with season three with Michael Burnham, is how it really took us on a roller coaster of, you know, will she stay in Starfleet? Will she leave Starfleet? And I mean, honestly, that was a good question for them to have her struggle with throughout the season. But to have, you know, as we talked about prior, have this weird sort of whiplash where she defies Saru, defies an admiral, goes off, does her own thing. We're basically left, we're returning back to season one Burnham, Mutiny Burnham era.
Right.
And then it's like the next episode, it's like, okay, are we going to continue this thread? This is really complicated now. She's kind of alienated her crew. Oh no, no one seems to notice it. No one seems to care except for Tilly. Like it's all in Tilly's head.
Well, Tilly was the only one who called her out.
Tilly was the one who called her out and she's the only one who interacted with her. But considering the fact that it seems like that crew talks to everybody else all the time based on their interactions, especially even in that episode about like, hey, what did I miss or whatever? Like I would be hard pressed to believe that no one just said, oh, Michael Burnham, she went on shore leave and they went, oh, okay. Like we're never given an explanation as to why no one seems to be bothered by the fact that she just defied an admiral and a captain.
And just as a quick aside, nobody on Discovery ever seems to take shore leave either.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's true too. Oh, and then Tilly's promoted to first officer. So you noticed that the first officer on this ship changed? Yeah. Huh. What do you think that's about? Like you would think that conversation would happen off camera and that would actually affect what we see on camera, but it never happened. It was just like, oh, that's just Burnham being Burnham. And I'm like, right. Well, that's a pretty big consequence.
Yeah. And
it's just swept under the rug. It reminds me, I don't know if you ever watched that show Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
But they had this season during the writer's strike where one of the characters accidentally kills somebody and buries the body. And that plot thread is never brought up again after the writer's strike. And that's what I felt like when I was watching this. I was like, you've literally buried a body. And I'm like, there's a grave right there. Why is no one talking about the fact there's a grave? Like I was saying, you know, it's just strange that Michael Burnham has gone through a character arc that doesn't seem to really affect the way people around her treat her. It's like, well, they treated her differently in season one. And then but now we have this huge turn of events again in season three. And we're just going to sweep it under the rug now that it's narratively complicated for us. And we're going to continue our story as if there was just a moment of doubt in her behavior, as opposed to she openly defied a captain and an admiral. I mean, we saw Kirk in the original Star Trek IV, you know, prosecuted for, you know, was it 8 or 10 violations of Starfleet regulations? And
right.
All the charges are dropped except the one of disobeying a superior officer, which was leveled at Kirk. And they reduced him in rank. Obviously, he was rewarded by it, but Star Trek didn't just go at that point, didn't say, well, Kirk, you're demoted from admiral to captain. You're still obviously the number one on the show. You're the number one on the ship. You're the number one on the call sheet. But they actually pay it off. That's actually an argument that General Chang makes in Undiscovered Country.
That
this guy is defiant. Look at what he did. he disobeyed the head of Starfleet and he got demoted from admiral to captain. Is that not true?
I was just going to add that reputation almost got him sentenced to prison.
It did get him sentenced to prison.
It did get, yeah, you're right. It did get him sentenced. He just broke out.
Yeah. But when you look at Discovery, I mean, obviously not with an exterior, you know, empire outside of the Federation, but if Starfleet in the 23rd century held the disobeying, and in many military organizations, the disobeying of a superior officer is a grave offense. And the fact that no one in the crew seems to be bothered by it, it's strange because it feels like it's almost like a moment that's missed, a missed opportunity for writers. And I don't know if it's because the writers are too busy trying to have other things happen, or they just simply in the midst of writing stuff, just kind of let it go by the wayside.
The impression that I got was and you touched on it, it's a little bit of this Kirk rebellion, Kirk rebelliousness, right? It's this tendency for Kirk to defy orders and go off and do his own thing. Now we can unpack, and we can probably spend a whole episode unpacking how that's far more acceptable when a guy like Kirk does it, as opposed to when we see Michael Burnham do it. However, I think that one big difference here is that, and I feel like it's embodied more in the Kelvin Kirk. I've said many times that Chris Pine is a great actor, but his character fails upwards. Yes. You know, it doesn't matter how many times he screws up, how many orders he defies, he's still going to get put back in charge of the Enterprise. So I feel like it is a little bit of Kirk that they're applying to Burnham, but it's the wrong Kirk.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the Kelvin universe, I was struck the other day, and I'm not sure if I heard this right, but there's a moment in Into Darkness early on, after Kirk is responsible for the Enterprise violating the Prime Directive, and granted, it's not like the Prime Directive hasn't been violated a number of times in Star Trek lore. All right, so that's beside the point. What I'm getting to, though, is that Admiral Pike mentions sending Kirk back to the Academy. And I'm just thinking to myself, wait a second. Did he not graduate? How is this guy captain of the Enterprise and he didn't graduate from training? Like, how did that happen?
I've heard of field promotions, but that's a little bit extreme.
It's field demotion to student?
Right.
Like, I maybe I misunderstood it. Again, this is why I'm hoping for, listeners, that you let me know if we're speaking out of turn on this. But I've never heard of anything where, in anywhere else, at least in Star Trek, that someone's demoted back to Starfleet. But the guy is also the captain of the Enterprise. And then, unfortunately, I think it's a product of the writing of the Kelvin universe. One thing I've argued often is that the major difference between Kirk and Prime Universe and Kelvin Universe is that Kelvin Universe Kirk is made to be the butt of jokes as opposed to being part of the joke or leading the joke. Obviously the thing in the first movie with his swollen hands is sort of like, oh my gosh, his hands are swollen because of the thing that Bones gave him. Or in the third movie, it starts off with like these little small dog-like creatures attacking him. And it's just like, Kirk is there for our amusement. He's not really there as a competent leader.
Right.
And that's the one thing I have to say about Kirk in the original series, that people aspired to be like Kirk because there was a level of competency. Now, I'm talking about the Chris Pine's Kirk in particular about this trait, because I don't think there's any character who's been a number one on a call sheet or number one first officer even in Star Trek, aside from the Chris Pine version, who is not competent.
Yeah.
I think he's the only incompetent person to be leading a ship, a space station, whatever in Star Trek. And it's kind of shocking to me that it's Captain Kirk.
What's shocking to me is that they never inform it. Right? Like the original series never had to show you Kirk's years in the Academy in order to convey the fact that he was a top level student. He's one of the youngest captains ever because he's just that damn sharp and bright.
Right. I mean, there was such a thing. I mean, if you look at the original series, the first season of it, Kirk is much more serious than he is in season two and further down the line. And I think that's a product of the writing, of course. And the Gene Roddenberry was trying to be very focused that Kirk is serious. In fact, Kirk, I don't think really even has that many love interests in the first season other than Edith Keeler.
Right.
You know, there's of his flirtation with the daughter in court martial, not court martial,
Conscience of the King.
Conscience of the King. Thank you. So other than Conscience of the King, when he's flirting with the girl above the shuttle bay deck, the shuttle deck, and aside from Edith Keeler in City on the Edge of Forever, I can't really think of a moment where Kirk really has anything along the lines of an interest or strong flirtation with some women. And of course, you know, people like to make fun of the Kirk of the 60s as being a big womanizer, and each episode he's making out with a green girl, which is really funny because in 79 episodes of the original series, Kirk encounters a green woman one time, and she's not a love interest of his. I think that's kind of interesting that that sort of trope, like Beam Me Up, Scotty,
Right.
out there about Kirk. I mean, there's Gamesters' Triskelion where a woman has greenish hair, depending on the color correction you see of that episode. If it's green or pink, I've seen various versions. But aside from the hair color, I don't, you know, there's Gamesters' Triskelion. There's obviously a few others where Kirk is sort of this, you know, ladies' man type of thing. But he's, again, he's made to be at least made to be competent. And the Kelvin universe makes our number one, you know, this character who we don't really aspire to be Kirk. I don't really think anyone aspires to be Chris Pine Kirk the same way that you would aspire to be Captain Sisko, Commander Sisko, or Michael
Right.
Burnham even. I mean, they all have their flaws, but they're all competent. And there's this, and that's the thing that's always been true about Star Trek, is there's a competency in people. And then that was, and that to me was a violation of that. In fact, that to me, bigger than any of the, you know, we talked in another episode about canon. I actually feel that the violation of a pre-existing character's identity, like the very soul of what makes that character, particularly an established character like a Kirk or a Spock or Picard, to outright violate sort of a level of respect or trust we have in these characters, that to me is greater than any canon break. And I know some people would say, well, Michael, what about the whole thing with the argument about Valeris and Saavik? You know, the fact that, you know, Star Trek VI, Nick Meyer originally intended Valeris to actually be the role of Saavik with Kirstie Alley, and then that was summarily changed. Obviously, the implications of it being Saavik for Star Trek VI are much, much, much greater, and it's a much bigger punch when you think about it if it were Saavik. But the fact of the matter is, it's not. And as a result, it's a different type of effect. Now, in the case of, like I said, in any of those instances, our lead characters are made to be, you know, respectful, competent, intelligent. And I don't know if I can really say those things about frat boy Kirk.
Yeah, I mean, the character portrayal that I felt was the worst, or at least the most egregious, came from Into Darkness. Just to do a sort of comparison, and again, this is an interesting way of looking at how your number one contributes to the story and contributes to in-universe the ship. So in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, it's you may be inclined to believe that Kirk beats him, but the truth of the matter is it's Spock who intellectually defeats Khan by exploiting a conceptual weakness. Khan is from the 20th century and has limited experience with starship combat. So Spock recognizes that if you drop down several thousand meters, because everything else is on an X and Y axis, drop on the Z axis, and then come right back up behind him. It was an intellectual exploitation. Now, in Star Trek Into Darkness, how does Spock beat Khan? He chases him down in the street and beats the hell out of him. Completely different. I felt like Into Darkness just, my issue with the J.J. Trek and the way he wrote the characters, these were not really the characters from Star Trek. You had all the tropes of them. You had the look of them. You had the things that you know in canon. But in truth, he was really writing Han, Chewie, and you can choose Leia. You can choose Luke. Maybe it's Obi-Wan. But his Kirk and Spock were pretty much always Han and Chewie. And that's the problem. That's not who they were. The character dynamics were completely different. And then you just have Bones, who's in there for an occasional bit of comic relief. Even though he was the third part of this moral, psychological triptych of leadership. Mm-hmm. This was literally, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is literally Gene saying, these are the qualities you need in order to be an effective leader. Whether it's a ship, whether it's a business, whether it's a production, you need to have a little bit of Bones, a little bit of Spock, and a little bit of Kirk. In the JJ movies, all of that is completely gone. And I realize that as their movies, you don't have as much opportunity to go. I think even Chris Pine said in an interview, you can't do Merchant Ivory Trek, right? You have to have some explosions. You have to have some things that are going on. That said, you don't have to skimp on the characters so much that you write completely different characters and just wedge the names in where they seem to fit, or the canon, to reference our previous episode.
I mean, not to spend too much of our time just focusing on JJ Trek with this, but the thing is, when you look at Spock going back to Wrath of Khan, in fact, and this kind of, I was actually thinking also about Lieutenant Worf. You know, there's that famous YouTube video of every time Worf suggests something and Riker or Picard shoots him down. You know, recommend we raise shields. Nope, we don't want to provoke them. Recommend that we hold them for safety, Captain. Nope. And then every time, it turns out that Worf was right. Basically the trope is, if Worf makes a recommendation and you shoot him down, chances are he was right. So when you look at Spock and Kirk, it's always invariably Kirk takes what Spock says and translates it into action. Like, I mean, as soon as Kirk beams back from Regula One, what's the first thing it does? They look at a tactical map and they're like, okay, we're going to be outgunned and outrunned. Well, Spock says there we have a Matara Nebula that we can get to. Kirk, okay, go to the nebula. Got it. Basically, he takes Spock's recommendation and goes with it. What's interesting to me, though, is that Spock is there offering this bit of information that Kirk takes and runs with it and makes command decisions based off of. Whereas Spock, whereas in other Trek, and I'm specifically targeting Discovery and Kelvin Trek, in that the first officer seems to be more about being at odds with the captain than being an executive of the captain.
Right, which is something that we've seen on occasion. You know, it's the first officer's duty to sort of argue with the captain on occasion if he feels that the captain isn't doing the right thing. At the same time, this seemed to become a trope on Discovery from the very first episode. Burnham is against Giorgio. Burnham is going against Lorca. Burnham is bristling against Saru. I can't think of a single captain whose orders she actually fully obeyed.
Mm-hmm. Well, even I would say that even when Saru was first officer to Lorca, you know, there was also that issue too. So, you know, and then in the Star Trek Kelvin universe movies, Spock and Kirk never really are completely on the same page, you know, especially obviously the first movie, they're meant to be at odds. It's about them joining up and becoming friends. I get it. So Right. That's part of your plot. But in a darkness, what's the first bone of contention between them? How does that literally reset the relationship? Spock reports to Admiral Pike about Kirk's violation of the Prime Directive. We're back at odds again. Here we go again. And it's like that. I don't remember their relationship ever in prior Trek ever being adversarial. So that going back to your notion about a violation of character, it's like, I understand the need for it as a writer to make it adversarial in the first film. I understand the need for some conflict in the second film. But why is the conflict between Kirk and Spock again? Why is it not somewhere else. I mean, you look at Kirk and Wrath of Khan, the very beginning of the movie, you know, there's a problem at Regular One. Kirk goes to Spock's quarters and says, you know, it looks like we need to go to Regular One. Spock's first reaction isn't, well, I'm captain here and it's logical for me to maintain things or whatever. He says, right. he says, I have no ego. You command the ship. You're my superior officer. And it's just like, that's it. I'm not fighting you about it. Go do your captain thing. Whereas it seems like that's an odds thing in Discovery and with Kelvin, is there's always like this friction between who's in charge, you know? And you talk about Sisko not being a captain. I don't think there's anyone at any point. Maybe Worf when it came to the Defiant, but I don't recall anyone on Deep Space Nine ever being like, well, you know, questioning the authority of Sisko from below.
If I recall, the only episode where that even comes close to happening, the crew of the DS9, the main crew, they've been possessed by some sort of entities or some alien being. So Kira is playing out this mutiny against Sisko, but that's it. At any other point in time, she totally respected it.
You know, Kira was always, and she wasn't even Starfleet. So you could even say, well, you know, her excuse is that she was Starfleet. Well, Michael Burnham was Starfleet. She was Defiant. Spock, Kelvin universe, definitely Starfleet. And yet there's this defiance of the captain. Now, right or wrong, my point here is that that's the way that Star Trek has started to lean in portraying the first officer on those shows. And my question is, you know, especially in the case of Michael Burnham being not a captain up until the very end of season 3, how did that affect what they could do with the story? Are we having these conversations about these characters? Would we have these conversations the same way about these characters if they were captain? If Sisko was a captain in season 1 of DS9 versus commander, his rank changed, would that have affected the storytelling you do?
That's a good question. I think that it depends on the series. For DS9, I don't think it would have changed much because, as I mentioned, Sisko was kind of the authority for everybody with the possible exception of Gold Dukat. And Gold Dukat was the sort of character he wasn't going to respect him no matter what his rank is.
Yeah, he could have been an admiral. It wouldn't matter.
Right, an admiral. It wouldn't matter. He's Gold Dukat and you're not. So, right. You know, to steal the old Chevy Chase joke, that was his character's perspective. As it pertains to Burnham, I think that, I'll be honest, I feel like the trend towards first officer versus captain adversary, it's just a lazy way of introducing conflict, right? On the one hand, it also, I'm not a stickler for Gene's rule that the bridge crew or the leadership, they never argue with one another. However, at the same time, if you go into any sort of military structure or you introduce yourself to anybody who's been in the military, you can very much disagree with someone. You can hate their guts, but there's still a chain of command and a level of respect that goes along with it. So I felt like that was baked into Star Trek, you know, the original series, TNG, the 90s versions, and then we get to New Trek, and it's this simple, I'm in charge and you're not. And now we create a conflict between that. And it's so easy. When Star Trek used to create conflicts for so many different reasons, there were conflicts between Kirk and Spock that never lasted long, but they were all about, I'm Vulcan and you don't understand. Mm-hmm. So these weren't about like, I want to be the captain because you don't know what you're doing, or I know the right choice. It was, they were cultural, or they were moral, or they were specific to the challenge of the episode, whatever they were facing. So I feel like it's so easy to just create this basic number one versus number two, you know, using the captain as number one in this context. It's so easy to do a number one versus number two conflict. You know, anybody can do the wolf at the bottom of the hill wants to be the wolf at the top of the hill. But Star Trek is about more than that. I felt like the conflict should come from a more ideological place versus I know better than you.
You know, something I would gravitate towards when I think about this is the first time in Star Trek we ever saw the conflict between the first officer and the captain was actually the motion picture.
You're right.
We had Decker. And that was the first time we ever saw that. And of course, at the end of the movie, neither one of them really wins or loses. They go their separate ways, so to speak. And, you know, Kirk continues on being Kirk and Decker goes on to some other dimension, supposedly. But my point is that we also did see a conflict between first officer and captain in Voyager and Enterprise to a limited extent. We obviously had Chakotay as being a member of the Maquis.
Right.
And there was the tension between him and Janeway, specifically between leadership between two factions, so to speak, on one ship. Now, the writers for Voyager played off of that off and on for, what, two seasons, three seasons? And then all of a sudden, it just like was completely forgotten. It's some peripheral thing until, you know, we had a ship in the bottle episode where we needed it.
Right.
You look at Enterprise, T'Pol. First officer. She's technically not she's not Starfleet. She's actually the second first officer in Star Trek who's not of Starfleet. The other one, of course, being Major Kira. Mm-hmm. Now, Subcommander T'Pol is made to be first officer of the Enterprise. And as a consequence of her being Vulcan, she's looked at as an outsider on the ship until she's accepted in seasons three or four or whatever. But very much that, you know, there is this not hard adversarial that we saw with Kelvin Spock, nor is it the complementary type of first officer you'd see with Riker and Picard, but it probably parallels a little bit closer to the relationship that I've seen between Janeway and Chakotay overall.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. There's some natural conflicts there. The interesting thing about the Enterprise conflict is that this time the captain has more, you know, has most of the animosity. Not relatively young, but young as I was when the first episode of Enterprise aired, I remember seeing Scott Bakula's character, Captain Archer, saying, you know, I'm great. Worse to the effect, I'm restraining myself from knocking you on your Vulcan ass. And my jaw dropped. I was like, that's a captain? You know, we had never seen anything like that before, with the possible exception of Kirk's bigotry towards Klingons in the movie series, the original series movies.
I think Sisko would have popped Dukat.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, Sisko would have loved to have punched Dukat many times. But I guess what I meant specifically is that, you know, you had never really seen a captain display that much hostility towards anybody, much less his own or who would be his first officer.
Right.
I felt like that was honestly kind of a good way of beginning, because I feel like these conflicts, they need to come from character or emotion or something. In the context, Archer was deeply embittered about all Vulcans because he had felt that they had held his father back from traveling through space. Kirk, obviously, his bigotry was based on his son was murdered by Klingons. So the conflicts that you have with Chakotay. Well, Chakotay ideologically believes differently, and then also he has the suspicion they're Starfleet. As soon as we get back, they're going to turn us in. So all of these conflicts seem to come organically, and then you have JJ verse, which is you cheated on my test, I don't like you, and then you have Discovery, where it is Burnham is the center of the universe. So I feel like, again, I'm not opposed to conflicts between the staff members or even a character needing to evolve beyond bigotry, but there needs to be a basis for that other than just some simplistic, we need a conflict here and these characters are going to start arguing.
So, you know, one show we haven't really talked about with regard to this dynamic, and I think we'd be remiss not to discuss this to a little bit, is Picard.
Mm.
There's technically, if anything, at least season one, because we don't have much to go off of, season one, he's kind of the captain in the fact that he's kind of got ideas and everybody listens to him, but he's not really the captain. He's the number one on the call sheet. but he's not the captain of the ship. In many ways, Picard actually shares leadership on the show with
Captain Rios,
exactly. Yeah, so Captain Rios, it's his ship. He's the captain. What's Picard? He's just a passenger?
That's a good point. I guess the vibe that I got from Picard was that, and this is sort of this is just me reading the performances of the actors, Rios is treating him like he's an admiral, even though he knows full well he has no rank, no authority. It's the Starfleet in him. He's still treating him like he's an admiral. So it's a little bit more, you know, this person, and this is a fascinating dynamic. Picard has no authority anywhere. Not with Starfleet, not on La Serena, and yet it's his reputation that automatically gives this dynamic of he's his visiting admiral, you know, unless he says something crazy, you know, I'm basically going to follow what he says to accomplish this goal. So I did get the feel that it's a little bit, the dynamic shifted, and that even though it's Rios' ship, he became sort of a second in command to a certain degree. At the same time, Picard didn't need to directly take command. He's moved beyond that. You know, he's not the person who needs to be in charge and give all the orders. And that said, he's still, you know, he has this authority. He has this moment where if anybody mentions that I'm dying, you're going to piss me off. So it's this weird dynamic of who's really in charge here, who's the authority. And of course, it's always Picard. But I did like the fact that it came organically. They did acknowledge that Rios, his core is Starfleet. And here's one of the most legendary captains or former admirals in history. And he automatically reverts back to his rank.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting to me that here we are sitting here talking about all this and talking about, you know, people who have been leads on the show and not the captain. And then here's Patrick Stewart, Jean-Luc Picard, having no rank and being the lead of the show. And I wonder if that's part also, I mean, it looks like a running theme when you look at New Trek. You have Michael Burnham, not a captain. You have Mariner, not a captain. Or Boimler, even, whoever you want to pick, any of them, not a captain. You have Picard, not a captain. Strange New Worlds will literally be the fourth show that they will have brought out. It will finally have the captain being a captain. Because even Star Trek Prodigy, it's not very clear that Janeway is in charge.
If I recall correctly from what I've read, so the part of the plot of Prodigy is that you have these alien children who are genius prodigies. They're on a training ship that somehow go somewhere. But the long story short, Janeway is the emergency hologram training commander. So she may be in charge, but I don't think she's actually leading the ship.
I don't think she's going to be in charge. And I'm obviously speculating. I'll tell you why is because you look at a child's cartoon and you're going to have a character like Janeway, at least in my mind, that's the character who, will spur a question that your kid characters will go off and spend the episode doing
right
somewhere in the, and then maybe offer check in and offer advice throughout the episode. And then in the wrap up kind of melds the theme of whatever happened in the episode into a message that goes to the kids.
Right. Anyways. She's your Obi-Wan.
Yes, exactly. That's what I see her being. She's not your Luke. She's not your number one. She's this character who we're going to see every episode, who bookends the beginning and ends of shows and probably somewhere in between. But I'd be really surprised if she's anything more than that. I think it's going to be all new characters from the standpoint of who's your lead.
Agreed. And just to continue on with the Star Trek animated thing that we're on now, right now, we haven't talked a lot about Beckett Mariner from Lower Decks. And I think that for her, her character, the interesting thing to me, and it's the theme of all Lower Decks, is, as I mentioned before, it's, you have this aspirational aspect to it. Well, Lower Decks kind of works because you have a character who isn't aspiring to do anything, but obviously has this personality issue, this block that is keeping her from reaching her full potential. And I felt like that's a very good way of playing it, because reaching her full potential doesn't necessarily mean that she'll become captain. We kind of presume that. We know that lots of people say that she would be a great captain, but clearly it doesn't feel like that's her best destiny or where she feels like she should go. So I kind of like the approach for Mariner insofar as that, yes, you have this character who's not the captain, who does need to aspire to another level, but that level isn't becoming captain. That level is finding herself and, you know, finding balance within her own life. I think that that's a very brilliant approach to it. It may be the only way I can think of, apart from, as I mentioned, the sort of cop show angle, that you can do Star Trek where the lead, the number one call sheet or in the series is the person who's leading the narrative, because otherwise there's nothing else to go on. Like, this person just does a different thing every week and that's it. There's no evolution to them. So yeah, I think that Lower Decks plays it the right way, because you're never quite sure if her destiny is to become a captain. Maybe it is. Maybe that is how the story ends. Maybe the last moment of Lower Decks is Beckett Mariner, you know, captain of her own ship or captain of the Enterprise FG, whatever the case. But again, we don't know. And I think that that's the fun of the journey with her character. It's that it's not so much that she has to accomplish XYZ tasks to become captain, or she has to beat these aliens or work out this peace treaty. The work she needs to do is on herself.
I was going to say one thing I was going to say about the speculation, not being too much of a canonista here, but from what I understand in canon, at the era of Lower Decks, the captain of the Enterprise should be Worf.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if we could get a Michael Dorn cameo on Lower Decks. I think he might have some fun with that.
Well, I mean, he still wants his Captain Worf show, which...
Well, that's true, yeah.
I mean, that's its own thing. Depending on what they do with it, I mean, we've never had an alien captain number one. That would be an interesting one.
It seems like it would be particularly challenging if the number one on your call sheet has to go through, you know, 2 to 3 hours of makeup every morning.
But really, let's face it. I mean, I can't imagine his makeup takes any longer than it does for, you know, Doug Jones as Saru. I mean, my God, he has to put on hooves.
You got a point there. Yeah, I forgot about that. And so it becomes an interesting question. How much of that, you know, Saru has the hooves and he has the hands and he has the headpiece. Is it just those three pieces and the rest is just Doug Jones's body?
I don't know. I mean, it probably depends on the shot. But I mean, Michael Dorn played Worf for like 12 years. I mean,
yeah.
He's in more episodes of Star Trek, for anyone who's not familiar with the hit trivia of this. Worf appears in more episodes of Star Trek than any other character.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. He's in, I think, all but 12 episodes of TNG.
Mm-hmm.
He's in most of the episodes of seasons 4 through 7 of DS9. And he's in all four next gen movies. Plus technically his grandfather, great grandfather, Colonel Worf.
In the Undiscovered Country. Right.
Right. So you can take or leave that one, but he's logged more time in the makeup chair in Star Trek, I imagine, than anyone.
And I'd be, yeah, I could definitely go for a Captain Worf show. It'd be interesting. And again, we're back to the same thing. He, you know, you have a character who seems to evolve into a captain, evolve into the lead.
I think it'd be kind of interesting just because we've always seen Worf has a little bit of that Klingon sort of quasi-fascist type of mentality to his character. Like, how Starfleet can you make a Klingon as a captain?
Story Trek is still brought to you by no one, but we are.
Hold on. We have a sponsor.
Oh,
we do. You and me.
Oh yeah. And listeners like you.
Yes. There's no Patreon or anything like this. We do this for the fun at funsies at the moment. Maybe we'll reconsider. We'll see. But you know, we're very thankful for anyone who tunes in, listens, and we'd love you to like and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform that you're listening to us on right now.
You can also find us on social media. We're at Story Trek MM on Facebook and Story _ Trek on Twitter.
Yes. And please, 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 we'd love to hear from you. And if you've got some comments or feedback about some of the things we've discussed, we're totally down to discuss it. And with that, I will bid adieu, as I am Michael Strategakis.
I'm Marshall Hopkins. Live long and prosper.